Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. A lot of political news to get to this week, including the Iowa caucus just being days away. It is the official start to the primary season on the presidential level, at least for the Republicans anyway. The Democrats, they've shifted the schedule a little bit, so South Carolina is technically going to be there first, although New Hampshire has its first in the nation primary law in place, requiring them to have the first one. So they're going to have a primary, both the Republicans and the Democrats, later this month, but the Democrats are not going to acknowledge that primary. It's going to be really interesting. So a lot of developments to follow on that front there, including a candidate jumping out just days before the race officially gets underway. And you may know who he is. In fact, I know you know who he is. He's a familiar face. Let's just say he's a Jersey guy. I think you know who I'm talking about. We're going to break that all down there. We have Politico New Jersey reporter Daniel Hahn. He will be here. We're going to talk to him about that, as well as some other headlines that are making the news in the world of politics here in New Jersey. Believe it or not, New Jersey has a lot of national headlines that are getting into the news lately. So we're going to break that all down with him here. But we got to go to Washington. Well, actually, we start in L.A., where Hunter Biden has pleaded not guilty to the tax charges levied against him. Hunter is currently facing 9 federal felony and misdemeanor tax charges, including for failing to pay reportedly $1.4 million between the years 2016 and 2019. Now, this comes after a plea deal with prosecutors fell apart over the summer, which would have avoided a trial and allow Biden to skirt the gun charges that he's also pled not guilty to by entering a pre-trial diversion program, which essentially he would have just gotten some help, you know, drug addiction, you know, not basically you would be told what not to do in all the type of situations and how firearms are supposed to be handled, all this and that. So he was supposed to enter that, but the initial deal collapsed when prosecutors wouldn't commit to closing the door on future litigation against Hunter Biden, as well as the judge expressing concerns over the terms of the agreement. So that judge was not thrilled what was being presented to her, so she scrapped the whole thing. And now the Biden legal team is having to deal with these obstacles on multiple fronts here, including what's going on in Washington there. Now, Biden's plea comes one day, just one, after he made a surprise appearance on Capitol Hill where his contempt of Congress hearing was taking place. So here's what went down here. Members of the House Oversight Committee were all set to debate whether they should hold him in contempt for defying a congressional subpoena, when all of a sudden, he walked right through that door with his attorney, Abby Lal, and sat down right in front of them. So, shifting gears, lawmakers then attempted to ask Hunter Biden direct questions and specifically looked at him when making their statements. Democrats, on the other hand, began to argue that, you know, since Biden's here, showed up, and agreed to testify publicly, that they shouldn't hold him in contempt. And then Democrat Jamie Raskin specifically brought up how some of the colleagues, Jim Jordan, Andy Biggs, and Scott Perry, all did the same exact thing, and none of this happened to them. They were not being held in contempt, and they were not referring those contempt charges to the DOJ. That's the argument that Raskin made there. Then it got even more interesting when Florida Democrat Jared Moskowitz later suggested he would vote to hold Hunter in contempt if all those Republicans we just mentioned were held in contempt also by all the people on the other side of the aisle. That he said, well, we'll take that vote. Why don't we have it? And then there are some Democrats who are saying, well, you know, since Hunter's here, why don't we get him on the stand right now? So, you know, obviously there were some people that were like, oh, let's ask him some questions there. Well, that didn't go according to plan here, because when Marjorie Taylor Greene was getting ready to ask Biden a question, him and his attorney decided to get up and leave just after being there for approximately 15 to 30 minutes. It depends on which out you look at to get the exact timing, but it was somewhere in that time frame. So they decided to get on up there, and as a result, Marjorie Taylor Greene's like, whoa, whoa, are you afraid? What are you afraid, Hunter? You don't want to take my question? So that caused a whole stir there. And then outside the committee room, Abby Lowell read a statement accusing Republicans of using his client as a way to attack the president, and repeated that Hunter offered to work with the committee multiple times in the past, but they, quote, cared little for the truth, close quote. Well, in the end, both the House Oversight Committee and the Judiciary Committees voted to recommend contempt of Congress charges right along party line. That's how that vote went down. So basically, both committees were tasked with this. The Judiciary Committee had their own hearing that happened simultaneously, but it didn't have as much drama as this oversight hearing. That's the one everybody was talking about, and all the TV stations were taking this thing live and getting all the pictures of Hunter Biden walking in, walking out, and then, of course, you know, doing a little meet and greet with the press outside the hearing room afterwards. Well, now this vote goes to the full House floor for a vote. So this is going to be interesting to see if the Republicans can get all of them together. But as you can imagine, this was quite the spectacle that happened here. And you're probably thinking to yourself, well, if you're a guy who's in all this legal trouble, you got these gun charges against you, then you got the tax charges, and then on top of that, you got contempt of Congress charges, why would you be going around appearing in public? Well, we have to dig in a little bit to the dynamics of this. It's important to know Abby Lowell is no slouch here. This is a guy who has been around the block. He understands how this works. I believe he even represented Senator Bob Menendez, who's now got his own legal troubles, which we'll talk about later. But we have all of that to keep in mind there, that Lowell is a guy who knows how to work this system. He is trying to thread the needle here. That, oh, look, well, Hunter showed up. He did show up. You people just were unwilling to have him testify. He's trying to get the loophole here to say that. Also, it's the political argument. Hunter Biden, yes, he's not a politician, but he's lived around them his entire life. You know, he had Beau Biden, who was the Attorney General of Delaware. Then, of course, his father, the President of the United States, who's been in politics since Hunter could talk. I mean, Biden was like one of the youngest senators in our history at the time he was elected back in the 70s. So, needless to say, the Bidens have been around forever, and Hunter has been around this. So he understands political moments. So that's what Republicans have accused him of, political theater. But Hunter is trying to make the point here that this is all political, and the Republicans are just coming after me because they want to come after my father, and they want to make the connection, and that my father had nothing to do with my business dealings financially. Remember, financially is the quote, and that's what Republicans are saying. Oh, well, now financially, well, did you offer some moral support? Was there some way that he allowed you to get the finances? So there's a lot of legal stuff happening with this. So that's what Hunter's trying to do. Now, the Republicans, of course, were caught off guard, but now they're trying to make a whole big deal of this. They're trying to say this is the two-tier justice system argument because, as you recall, they had Steve Bannon and Peter Navarro and Mark Meadows. They held all these guys in contempt. Steve Bannon actually went to jail. And they're saying that probably is not going to happen to Hunter. So then that's the real question that the Biden DOJ is going to have to deal with is whether, since Congress, if they get this vote through, it just has to go through the House, as you remember from the Trump era. It doesn't necessarily have to go through the Senate. If it just goes to the House and they send it to the DOJ, what's the DOJ going to do? Is Merrick Garland going to prosecute Hunter for this? Or are they going to let it go? Say, well, you know, not really a big deal. He showed up and that's the end of it. That's what we're going to have to watch. But the Republicans have a balancing act they have to do too, because one, they got to show the base, well, listen, this is a two-tier justice system. This guy's full of crap. Also, they have to go after Hunter because the base loves to go after Hunter and they think there's a connection with the president. They have to connect the president to Hunter. As you may know, that is the reason why Hunter Biden was asked to appear before this committee, because they want more information on the business dealings. Because that part, the government has not confirmed whether they are in fact looking into that. They haven't. They just have said that they're not closing the door on any future stuff. There's not really much being, you know, the tax charges kind of touch on this a bit, but not extensively on the foreign business. Basically saying he got money from somewhere overseas and then he failed to pay the taxes. Not so much, it was more about the evasion rather than acting as a foreign agent. Nothing, no FARA violations there, which is basically failing to register as a foreign agent. That hasn't been really delved into a lot. They could be diving into it, and we just don't know. It hasn't really come out from the DOJ or the special counsel's office. We're going to have to see where the Hunter Biden thing goes, and politically, how does it hurt the president? How much does it consume the president? Because people around him are concerned he's going to focus more on this than his reelection bid, and he's going to get distracted, and he's going to start messing up, and then playing into the Republican Trump narrative that, oh, he's not up for the job, he's an old man, he has dementia, and all this and that. So there's the balancing act there, that if the Republicans go too hard in on the Hunter stuff and they can't end up connecting the dots to President Biden, then it just makes it look like they're going after witch hunt investigations as opposed to trying to solve the problems of everyday Americans. So it's a balancing act on both sides here. And we're going to have to see where the American people, because it seems like the American people are on board with the fact that they believe something was done wrong, that Hunter did something wrong. They seem to be on the same page there. Majority says that in the polling. The question is the connectivity. They think maybe President Biden might have done something wrong, but the American public isn't 100% convinced yet. So now it's on the House Republicans to get that evidence that's gonna persuade the people who are in the middle, the people who can actually change the election. You got your home team on board. Everybody on the Republican side is all up in arms about this. They're saying, yep, we believe it. There's enough here. But the middle of the road people, and obviously the Democrats, are not on that same path. Well, maybe there's some, but they're few and far between. That is the challenge that is at play here. And that's what we're going to have to see, and how much this affects the overall campaign. Now, of course, Hunter Biden isn't the only one who's under the microscope in the legal system. Former President Trump, he's also there. He's got multiple cases he's dealing with. This man is flying all over the place this week. You might see him. He's in Iowa. He's in D.C. He's in New York. He is just, you can't keep track of the guy anymore. He's just going from one place to the next here. Well, the big thing that everybody was talking about this week, this is how the week kind of ended, was former President Trump's civil fraud trial in New York ending in a dramatic fashion. How, you might ask? Well, the judge had previously expressed an openness to allowing the former president to make his own closing statements. I should note, this is an unusual thing. Usually just the attorneys. Usually the clients themselves, unless they have some type of legal background, really don't weigh in on closing statements. They don't talk at all. They let the attorneys do it, and then the judge or the jury makes their decision. So keeping all that in mind, but when the time came around to have this all happen. The judge said that it wasn't going to happen. Well, here's why. The judge and Trump's attorneys couldn't come to an agreement about what the terms would be for what the former president could say and what he could not say. Erdogan wouldn't allow Trump to bring up, well, the judge himself, then those who are involved in the case, like Letitia James, the New York Attorney General, the clerk who has come under scrutiny for her association with the senator, the Democratic senator in that state, and who happens to be the Senate Majority Leader, Chuck Schumer, and also others in the court system, because, of course, the former president is going around saying it's a two-tier justice system. So he said, well, he can talk, but he can't mention this. And then the attorney said, well, that's infringing on his free speech. We can't allow that. So the judge said, well, I haven't heard from you, so he's not speaking tomorrow. It's not happening. And they were going on emails, change back and forth, and the Trump team ultimately didn't respond to that, and he just made his own decision on that. So you thought, okay, well, we're not hearing from Trump today. That's kind of the end of the story there. That's what people were thinking about on Thursday. And then it kind of took an interesting turn of events there. So the Trump legal team finished up their arguments, and then one of his attorneys decided to ask the judge again if Trump could speak, except this time he said, well, you know what, only for 2 to 3 minutes. How does that sound? Well, Erdogan then said, all right, well, we'll give him 5 as long as he sticks to the facts. That's a direct quote from Erdogan. All right, so Trump got up there. He said he was an innocent man and the trial is a fraud on him specifically. He said the fraud was about him, the fraud of him, not so much that he committed fraud, but that the fraud trial is a fraud. That's what he said. But then he went after the New York Attorney General, Letitia James, claiming that this is only happening because she doesn't want him to get elected and that she hates him. Well, the judge got all up in arms and said that. He told the lawyers at one point, hey, guys, you got to control your client. So that didn't go over as well as you expected, but he still continued. He made the statement, and that was that. So Judge Erdogan says he'll make up the final decision. He'll make a final round of the decisions and release it by January 31st. So he says he has till the end of the month. As you know, he had that initial ruling saying that he believes the Trump organization and the Trump family committed fraud. This is more about the damages of how much it would be. We'll have to see there, as well as if the Trump legal team files an appeal. But what's happening here is it's a political war on both fronts. You have the Democrats who are kind of making this the whole political war thing too, because obviously they're talking about it. They're saying, well, we're having a 4-time indicted former president run on the Republican side. Is this going to be the end of democracy? So the democracy argument, because remember, that's how Biden opened up the year, kind of kickstarting this campaign. Democracy, democracy. This is a common theme for the Democrats, especially in light of January 6th, that this is the message they're trying to say. This is a choice between democracy and authoritarianism or dictatorship. They're trying to make this a governing philosophy argument, this deep discussion. The Republicans, during this court thing too, they're trying to make it say, hey, you know what, there's a double, this is the two-tier justice system. Again, back to what we were talking about earlier with Hunter Biden, that your guys, they all can do whatever they want and get away with anything, but our guys, we're just trying to mind our own business, and you're making up charges against us. So the civil fraud trial, since it is not a criminal trial, you know, both sides you could argue, are using it to their political benefit. Trump to say he's a victim, and then Letitia James saying, well, you know, we're holding Trump accountable. Because that was a primary promise on James's part when she got elected. She would go after Trump and hold him accountable and go after all these people, which she has. And Trump, of course, is trying to, one, defend his own interests as well as campaign for president, and also to be this conservative warrior that a lot of Republicans are looking for. He's trying to make himself be that guy who is standing up to the big establishment and all these people, and that they're only coming after him because he's winning. And if he wasn't running for re-election, they wouldn't be doing anything. Again, we're going to have to see where that argument goes. And he also says he's innocent of all this stuff. And specifically on the criminal stuff, he says he has immunity. Because this whole civil fraud thing came days after he attended an appeals court hearing in Washington, D.C. So again, he's in another location where the panel of judges, so there were three of them, appeared to be skeptical of his claim regarding presidential immunity. The judges there, they questioned whether conducting political activities related to his election lawsuits, you know, all the ones where he filed saying that there was irregularities and funny business going on, those lawsuits, they were unsure whether they fell within his quote-unquote official duties. So they were pressing his attorney pretty hard there. And the attorney's argument was basically like, well, there would be no end in sight if presidents didn't have immunity, citing decisions made by Obama and George W. Bush that, you know, some might say are wrong, but they might not fall necessarily in the grounds of being illegal. And he talked about the war decisions that were made by both presidents, specifically with Bush going into Iraq and then Obama talking about Libya and all of that. And those type of decisions, are those presidents going to be, or would they be prosecuted under that law? That, oh, well, they didn't have immunity and people got killed and, you know, they quote unquote misled the American people, because that's what a lot of the people who are against these wars have claimed that presidents have done, that they misled, and that there really were, in the case of Iraq, no weapons of mass destruction. That's been the saying there. And of course, some Bush proponents have said that they moved the weapons from Iraq to Syria there. And of course, you know, the Bush administration did, depending on which part of it, did somewhat of acknowledge that maybe they might have miscalculated some stuff. But the point being is the Trump team's argument is if Trump doesn't have the immunity, then Bush would have to be prosecuted. And then all of it go back in time. And where does it end? Where does it start? It's like Pandora's box. Well, the former president repeated this claim after the hearing, saying you have to be able to do your job as a president. That's the Trump argument. And that is what the crux of it is, that there is some form of immunity that presidents have that the average American does not. And this could possibly, we have to see what there is, could be a political component to this as well. The component of the politics is the stall tactic, right? Even if you know these appeals may not actually work, it could be a stalling because, as we see in the polling, if there is one conviction, that could flip some numbers Biden's direction. That Trump, some people, you know, they'll stick with him through the indictments, but if he gets convicted, they're not so sure on that. They don't know if they really want a convicted president in the White House. So if you're Trump, you just keep pushing it. You push till you get the election. And then you're going to be having your Justice Department. And we'd have to see, you know, there could be an expectation that maybe the new Attorney General would not see these cases as consequential or necessarily the same importance that Merrick Garland sees them, that maybe they would try and get these dismissed, then they would drop them. Maybe they would fire special counsel Jack Smith. We have to see. We don't know whether they would want to do that necessarily at all, because then you might face the same allegations that Merrick Garland has faced with Hunter, that he has not gone far enough with the Hunter investigation. It's the sensitive matter that they have to do, but nevertheless, it is something that the Trump team can hang their hat on. Like, whoa, we can't start. We can't keep these trials going. Because as you know, they had to put a pause there on the January 6th case. That federal elections case, there had to be a little bit of a pause because of this presidential immunity stuff. And another case that he is now trying to get dismissed is the Georgia election case, basically on the same grounds, the presidential immunity. And then it's a question of whether that extends into state law, because the Georgia case is a state case from Fani Willis, who is the Fulton County DA. And she is someone who works on half of the people in Atlanta, Georgia, and that surrounding suburban area there. That's her thing. She is not a federal employee. And of course, obviously, there's news around that. Basically, that you start to hear a lot of this more in conservative circles than anywhere else, that she had an improper relationship with one of the prosecutors on this case. So, you know, the judge and the prosecutors, they all had some type of relationship going on. So if that is true, that Fani Willis had a thing with the judge and they had a little bit of a fling going on, and then some of these other prosecutors also got in all this, that would be a problem. Again, we have to let the facts come out as they may, but if that reporting does keep holding true and continue and actually be in all, you know, whatever your feeling is, because some people are skeptical about these ties, but we'll call it as we'll say that, let's say it is true, then it's a problem for the case. And because, you know, Brian Kemp, the governor there, has already faced calls to have a special session of the legislature to try and remove Fani Willis. And, you know, if that kind of evidence came out, maybe Kemp would say, you know what, we're going to have to do something about this. He may not be the biggest Trump fan in the world, but from what we understand, Kemp is going to try and help Trump win the state of Georgia if Trump does end up being the nominee. So, you know, it might be in Kemp's best interest there to do that. And we're going to see where all these Trump cases play out here. But again, this is not the only 2024 presidential news, believe it or not. Even though Trump is the front runner and has a lot of the oxygen in the room, there's so much more to talk about. Here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. Former Governor Chris Christie has been caught on a hot mic bashing his now former presidential primary opponents. Just before calling it quits, Christie can be heard on the audio of his live stream where he was making the big announcement. This was just before all that went down, saying former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley is, quote, going to get smoked, close quote, in the primaries. He also said Florida Governor Ron DeSantis called him up, quote, petrified, close quote. This comes as there's been some speculation going around for weeks now that Christie could drop out and potentially endorse Nikki Haley. We'll have to see if that still holds true, considering now you got him on the recording going after not only her, but then also talking a little bit about a conversation that he had with Ron DeSantis. The feed got cut off there at the point where he talked about the petrified. You heard some other guy like saying all the polling numbers, and then the feed went down from there. But we'd have to imagine is something interesting. And of course, Ron DeSantis said, I agree, Nikki Haley is going to get smoked, but didn't really address the part about the petrified. That's something we haven't heard as much of Ron DeSantis talk about in the initial response here. Of course, check your sources on that, because as you know, things change and we try and keep things as updated as possible, but this is a podcast and it is recorded. So, you know, things change between now and when you're probably listening to it. Well, anyways, join me now to break this all down in this latest development is Politico New Jersey reporter Daniel Hahn. Daniel, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Joey.
Former Governor Chris Christie dropping out of the 2024 race. This comes just days before the Iowa caucus, where Governor Christie, in the lead up to this thing, really wasn't putting too much money or resources in the state. He was more focused on New Hampshire. Based on your experience covering New Jersey politics, what you know about him, what do you make of this decision for him unexpectedly to drop out just before the primary season officially kicked off?
Certainly. I think that this was an abrupt decision. This probably caught many people off guard, because not too long ago, former Governor Chris Christie was putting out ads vowing that he will not drop out. And now he is. I think that the conventional wisdom of this development is that this is something that is going to benefit former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley in her bid for the Republican nomination, especially in a state like New Hampshire, where Nikki Haley's within, depending on what polls you're looking at, within striking distance of former President Donald Trump. And right now she seems to be the most formidable opponent against him in the Republican primary. And there had been a really big concern before amongst anti-Trump GOP, both politicians and voters, that by having Christie remain in the race, he was splintering that anti-Trump, the anti-Trump vote, both within New Hampshire and just throughout the general primary process for the Republican nomination. So we'll see how this fares for Nikki Haley in New Hampshire. Primary there is just at the end of the month. It was unexpected.
You brought up Nikki Haley. She's currently running second to Trump in New Hampshire, as well as kind of gaining steam as the runner-up overall over Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's been in this race for quite a while now. For a while, he was seen as the true alternative to Trump. That seems to be shifting direction there. Now, in terms of an endorsement, Chris Christie has said he's not looking to put anyone out. That seems to be what the campaign is telling us, that he's not going to endorse anyone until at least after the Iowa caucus, because he wants to give whoever it may be momentum going into New Hampshire. Now, although he has criticized Haley in recent days, he has given her some praise when they were on the debate stage together of a couple debates back. Do you see him endorsing her or endorsing another candidate? Or do you, in fact, see him maybe just not endorsing anyone at all, just, you know, going back to New Jersey and, you know, kind of chilling?
Mm-hmm. I think it's hard to say right now. And then there's a further question of what impact would a Christie endorsement really have? Because he does poll rather, he tends to be generally unpopular amongst Republican primary voters. Now, that being said, as we discussed before, people who are Chris Christie supporters in the primary are anti-Trump voters. So, you know, Christie dropping out is not going to be something that benefits Donald Trump. It's hard to see it benefiting someone like Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's also running conservative in the more conservative lane. So just by nature of Chris Christie dropping out, I think it's a boon to Nikki Haley, but we'll see.
Now, I want to turn to more local politics here. Governor Murphy delivered his State of the State address this week. He touted a lot of his accomplishments that he has had over the last 6 years, 7 years as governor. And he also mentioned some key priorities that he's looking to accomplish this year and for the rest of the term as he closes out his final term here. What are the key takeaways from this speech that you saw?
I think at a very high level, affordability has been a really large focus within Trenton within the past few years. I believe even the governor's office press release on the State of the State mentioned make New Jersey affordable or something along those lines. So that's just one key component to think at a very high level. And some specific items that he mentioned were something like eliminating out-of-pocket costs for abortions on state health plans, which is actually something that the governor has supported since around late 2020, but hasn't been able to get through the democratically supported legislature. And that's not to say that the governor has not been successful in getting many of his abortion or reproductive rights related agenda accomplished, but that's just one in particular that has stalled for the past few years. You saw a big, speaking to affordability, there's a push for a medical debt relief legislative package, building on some initiatives that he had in the current budget cycle for a pilot program that would help eliminate medical debt that hasn't gotten off the ground yet, but we'll see where that lands. And then some other things that have that he's either pushed for or that have existed within the legislature, such as same-day voter registration, lowering the voter age for school board elections to 16 and 17-year-olds, which has been pushed by state senator and Union City Mayor Brian Stack, as well as supporting the affordable housing push that's been announced from Senate President Nick Scutari and Assembly Speaker Craig Coughlin during the lameback session, which they sought to accomplish but ultimately did not.
I want to go to one thing that you brought up, and that is the out-of-pocket costs for birth control and abortion. This is, like you mentioned, something that Governor Murphy has been pushing for a while now, and that majority in the state assembly has expanded. He hasn't been able to accomplish it yet. Is he going to be able to push that now? Because as you know, they tried to push a constitutional amendment to get abortion on the ballot to make it a constitutional amendment. Then they also have all these Democrats who are privately more socially conservative on the issue, or in the case of Abby Schnall, who just got elected from the red 30th district down in the Lakewood area. He's not so much in favor of those big social issues. Is he going to be able to put the coalition together to finally get this bill to his desk so he can sign it?
I think that the governor has the best odds that he has had since 2020, when he first put support behind this and actually getting this passed through the legislature. Taking a step back, I think it's important to note that not only did Democrats in the assembly expand their majorities during the 2023 election, but you also saw retirements from a handful of key Democratic lawmakers who had either been hesitant to support or just outright oppose abortion rights in the state. They have retired and been replaced with Democrats who are presumably or have a track record of being more supportive of on issues related to abortion rights. I'm thinking of State Senator Fred Madden, who voted against codifying abortion rights into state law. He has been retired and replaced by another Democrat. A handful of members of the assembly who had also abstained from legislation that would have codified abortion rights into state law, they have also stepped aside. So when you combine that with the fact that there's just a larger Democratic caucus in the assembly and the 2023 election results, where a lot of Democrats campaigned on abortion in competitive districts, and they won in part because of that, and also just the national climate with the Dobbs decision that overturned Roe v. Wade, and that this has proven in both blue states and red states to be an electoral motivator and something that's popular. I think that all those things that we just mentioned combined makes the odds better of getting that bill to the governor's desk that would scrap out-of-pocket costs for abortions on health plans. Although, with all that said, you never know what will happen in Trenton at the State House. So we'll see.
You also brought up the push by Murphy to expand voting access. A couple initiatives he's putting on the table is lowering the age to cast a ballot in a school board election to 16 and 17. It currently sits at 18, along with every other election here in the state, or at least for the general election. as well as implementing same-day voting registration. Now, the governor just signed a bill allowing 17-year-olds to vote in the primaries if they're going to be 18 by the general election. How do you see New Jersey voters responding to this? Are they going to be in support of this? Do they want it? Or is it something maybe it's not as important to them?
You know, what I think is interesting is that actually just this past week on Wednesday, New Jersey's largest city, Newark, actually voted to allow 16-year-olds and 17-year-olds to vote in school board races. And that came just the day after the State of the State address. So there does seem to be some momentum in this space. Although all of that being said, same-day voter registration has been something that has been met with skepticism from Senate President Nick Scutari. So that is a hurdle that the governor will have to overcome during legislative negotiations. But we'll see where all this lands.
Now, as you know, there's critics to implementing the voting access as well as expanding abortion access. State Assembly Minority Leader John DeMeo and State Senator Declan O'Scanlan responded to the State of the State address by accusing the governor of prioritizing, quote, pie in the sky, unquote, policies. They say he hasn't done enough to make the state affordable, called abortion a non-issue in New Jersey, and say his proposal to lower the voting age undermines the fact that 18 is when someone is seen as an adult under the eyes of the law. Given that the GOP underperformed in last year's election, does this messaging change the game for the party in the state, or is it because it's going to be more of the same?
So I think it's just important to think about the context here. Generally, when the Republicans give their response to the State of the State address, or at least during the Murphy administration, or even in general, when it's the minority party is opposite that of the governor in office, you generally see this opposition. So that in itself is not unusual. What I do think is interesting is the Republicans' response to abortion. You mentioned that some of the Republican lawmakers called it a non-issue. The way that they've addressed this during the 2023 elections is that they've tried to argue that abortion rights in New Jersey are settled via state law, state Supreme Court precedents. So it's at least Republicans have argued it's not access to abortion is not something that they could easily or readily impact directly, and that it's not something that needs to be therefore addressed, kind of sidestepping the issues, especially since abortion rights have been proven popular in both New Jersey and elsewhere.
Now, towards the end of the speech, Governor Murphy brought up artificial intelligence and announced a new initiative in which he called an AI moonshot, which aims to facilitate innovative technology as well as bringing together thought leaders and inventors to allow New Jersey to be a nationwide leader in expanding this industry. This is kind of an unusual focus to bring up in a State of the State address because it's typically something we see discussed mainly at the national level, not so much the state level. It's more like the federal government is trying to put money into this, or it's some national organization that is putting money into this. What was the thought process behind Murphy bringing this up in the speech?
I think that there's a lot of excitement around artificial intelligence, generative artificial intelligence. And I believe it was even this week that we saw across the river in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul set aside or proposed a few hundred million dollars in state funds for an AI research center, so to speak. And this is not exclusive to New Jersey, but people are generally viewing AI as a transformative technology. The governor yesterday likened it to what the internet was back in the 1990s, and it could be just that transformative. There's a lot of debates on how do you regulate this, how do you use it ethically, and I think that both at the federal level and state level, this is an issue that elected officials want to stand on.
There's always been speculation about what Governor Murphy's future would be. As we saw in the speech, he had touted a lot of progressive agenda items that he says he was able to accomplish while he has been in office, and also like to tout the state as a model for the nation. That's something you hear a lot in a presidential candidate. Although he didn't mention as much of the national issues as he did in previous speeches, is this kind of an inkling that Murphy's looking to be more involved in the Democratic Party at a national level once he's done serving out his term as governor?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that some important context to keep in mind is that his wife, First Lady Tammy Murphy, is running in a competitive Democratic primary for U.S. Senate to replace the currently indicted Senator Bob Menendez. And I think that thinking about the events that happen at the State House between now and the June primary through that lens is something important to keep in mind. And speaking to what the governor's next steps are, I think it's important to keep in mind that Governor Murphy really comes from more of a national background in the Democratic Party. He's not necessarily someone who rose through the ranks of local New Jersey politics or even the State House. He's somebody who was, I believe, a treasurer at the DNC or in a position akin to that. He was an ambassador in Germany under the Obama administration. So he's someone that comes more with a national political background rather than a local New Jersey one. And it's an interesting question to see what happens next in his career as his term expires come 2026.
One thing Murphy noticeably didn't bring up was the migrant crisis. Specifically, he didn't mention the buses of migrants arriving at transit hubs across the state the last couple of weeks. What was the thought process behind this? Is this something that the Murphy administration is kind of not really wanting to talk about, or is it just something that just didn't really fit the mold of the speech?
Mm-hmm. I believe the governor made a passing reference to immigrants, saying something to the effect of immigrants are the backbone of New Jersey. And those are remarks that were definitely noticed by immigrants' rights groups and immigrant advocates. Speaking specifically to the migrant busing, New Jersey's playing a nascent but unusual role in it, because migrants are being bused from the southern border to New Jersey, but they're going to New Jersey with New York City as their final destination. They're boarding trains within New Jersey headed to New York City. Part of the reason why you're seeing that is because New York City Mayor Eric Adams recently instituted an executive order limiting when buses of migrants can come into the city, and also requiring advance notification. And you're seeing a large uptick of migrant buses stopping through the state as a workaround to that. But even amidst all this, a supermajority are not staying within the state. They're using New Jersey more as a transit point to head to their final destination, which is New York City.
You brought up the fact that this is more of the pit stop within the overall trip for these migrants, that they're being bused from Texas, but the ultimate goal is to use NJ Transit to get them across the river to New York City because of that notification policy. Now Governor Murphy is kind of trying to implement his own in that regard. But the Trenton mayor, Reed Gusciara, did say that there was some migrants who stayed behind with their families. And there seems to be some division within the party of how to address the issue. Edison Mayor Sam Josie says his town can't handle these migrants and that he'll send them back on a bus to the border if they try to stay here. While there's others who say the state has a moral obligation to take care of these migrants and to help these immigrants survive here in America. Could this potentially be a political problem for Democrats in the state down the road?
I think that we'll have to wait to see whether the situation stays the way it is, or if it escalates, or if for whatever reason there are more requests from New York City upon New Jersey. We'll have to wait and see, because as we mentioned before, at the moment, New Jersey is really just a place for people to go off buses and onto trains headed to the city. And while local officials have said that there have been a handful, a smattering of people who are not going on the trains and staying within the communities. The local officials that I've spoken with have said that that generally happens when the people on the buses have family to go to, they know somebody in the area or something akin to that. So New Jersey's not experiencing really this. New Jersey is not experiencing what New York City is experiencing right now in terms of migrants staying there while being bused from the southern border. But New Jersey certainly is playing a part in it right now, at least.
That wasn't the only news that we found out that about migrants in New Jersey. In fact, you have some exclusive reporting in which the Murphy administration considered allocating $5 million in COVID funds to deal with a potential migrant surge as a result of the expiration of Title 42 last year. What more can you tell us about what you found?
So these records predated the current busing situation within New Jersey. These actually, the records that we obtained were signed in June of 2023 from senior officials within the Department of Human Services. And the records that we obtained were basically an application, an internal state application to use COVID funds, requesting setting aside $5 million in the event that there's a, quote, influx, end quote, of migrants headed into the state, be it by bus or other means. And the intention of the $5 million was for things like mass shelter, food, crisis counseling, and any other services, social services that would be needed for newly arrived migrants. I think it's important to note that this proposal was never followed through on. It didn't come into fruition, but I think it is both interesting and worth noting because it provides a look into what state officials were considering should the situation happening within New York City also happen within New Jersey.
Now, it is important to note here that the Murphy administration, like you said, did not go through with the plan, but was there any inkling that from your reporting of why they didn't ultimately end with it? Was it the fact that Title 42 expiring didn't end up being the big surge that some people thought it was? Was it that they realized that they didn't have the resources for it? Because Governor Murphy last year publicly around the same time said, New Jersey can't handle this. We're not going to be able to take some of these migrants in. And then you hear about this that's been going on behind the scenes. What was the reasoning behind ultimately saying, nah, we're not going to do it?
We haven't really gotten a clear answer on that. And I think that the context that you mentioned with the Atlantic City Airport, and for people listening, back over with the summer of 2023, I believe, August to September, the Biden administration considered housing migrants at the Atlantic City International Airport from New York City, although at the time that proposal also never came to fruition, was never followed through on, and it received a lot of pushback from local elected officials on both sides of the aisle, and the governor said that the state didn't have the resources for it at the time. And the application, the records that we're actually talking about, even predate the governor's remarks on that. But, you know, we're talking about $5 million here. But as mentioned before, New Jersey hasn't received the influx of migrants staying here. You know, we definitely received an influx of migrants bused here on the way to New York City, but we have not seen, or at least it's been publicly acknowledged that New Jersey is experiencing what New York City, Chicago, or Denver are experiencing as it comes to migrants arriving here and needing social services, needing housing, and other resources like that.
Now, in regards to the politics of this, is this something that's going to be noticed amongst New Jerseyans? Is this something we're going to see Republicans talk about and try and attach every Democrat who's running for office in the state, including the governor's wife, First Lady Tammy Murphy, for Senate? Is this something we're going to see more of, or is this kind of going to fade into the background?
You know, I think that you've generally seen a lot of pushback from Republicans on the Murphy administration's progressive stances on handling migrants. I mean, the governor famously said in his 2017 bid for governor that he would make New Jersey a sanctuary state if needed. And He did indeed follow up on progressive policies that are pro-immigrant, like granting driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants, providing college financial aid to undocumented immigrants. And you're still seeing pretty often Republicans criticizing the Murphy administration's stance on this issue. So I'm sure that even if New Jersey's role right now in all of this is limited, it's something that will probably come up in campaign literature possibly come 2024.
Speaking of the 2024 campaign, Senator Bob Menendez addressed the latest allegations against him on the Senate floor this week. In his remarks, he called the latest superseding indictment accusing him of providing assistance to the Qatari government sensationalist. Menendez said, quote, "The United States Attorney's Office is engaged not in a prosecution, but a persecution." His approval rating is currently in the toilet here in New Jersey. He also asked a court this week to throw out the indictment altogether. Is he winning anybody over by doing this?
I think that the latest superseding indictment that was unveiled by federal prosecutors doesn't necessarily do much to change the status quo, other than the fact that it does keep the Menendez indictment in the news. We still don't know if Senator Menendez plans to run for re-election to the U.S. Senate, although if he did, he would face steep odds in both a Democratic primary, where he would face two well-funded candidates with name recognition, and even in a blue state like New Jersey, if somehow Menendez won a Democratic nomination, it would be a competitive general election, possibly. We'll see where this lands, but generally, I think that after the indictment came out in September, you saw Menendez's approval ratings plummet. The latest superseding indictment may further that, but I don't think this is necessarily changing a lot of people's minds.
And finally, before I let you go here, how does this change his own decision process? Because we've seen a couple drips with this. This isn't like, oh, the whole indictment came out at the same time and then went from there. We got the initial one where we heard about the gold bars. Then we heard about him acting as an agent to the Egyptian government. That's the allegation for the second. And now the Qatari government and those allegations there. What is the timeline for Menendez? Because we know there's dates on the calendar for when he has to decide whether he's running as a Democrat or even as an independent. At what point does Menendez say, okay, you know what, this is too much, I'm not going to run for re-election? Or that he says, you know what, I'm going to throw my hat in the ring because I think this is a bunch of crap. When does Menendez ultimately make that decision?
Well, two important dates to keep in mind here. The date to actually file to run in the Democratic primary is sometime around March, and then the primary is in early June. And the reason why all of this is important is because the Menendez trial is set to begin shortly before the June primary. So if Menendez were to follow through running for re-election, he would have to juggle the responsibilities of both being a U.S. senator, defending himself in court, and making his case to the New Jersey electorate, who currently don't think very highly of him, that they should give him another shot. So that's a very tall order, but you know, Senator Bob Menendez is not one who has been known in New Jersey politics to leave quietly or quit. So we'll see where it lands.
Yeah, we'll have to see where this goes. That trial is in May, and we'll have to see what Menendez does and all that. Politico New Jersey reporter Daniel Hahn, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that about does it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on X, formerly known as Twitter, @Block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram @Joey.Block.39. Again, that is @Joey.Block.39. Well, thank you so much for listening. It has been a pleasure. We'll be back again next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports, New Jersey.